Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 495 years and 6 months ago today, on April 27th, 1521, a Pacific Island chief and his warriors fought a pitched battle with Spaniards and killed Ferdinand Magellan, whose followers had to finish his ocean circumnavigation of the earth, the first by Europeans. The island chief's name was Lapu Lapu. A fish is named after him. And April 27th is a national holiday in the Philippines, the islands named after the king of their conquerors a few years after Lapu Lapu repelled Magellan's incursion. A large marker set up on the site of Magellan's death praises the great Portuguese navigator, and the other side gives tribute to Lapu Lapu for defeating the first European invasion in the Pacific. That ambiguity acutely illustrates the clash between Asian and Caucasian cultures throughout the half millennia since, a minuscule example of which is the major subject of today's program. My mother, Josephine, daughter and granddaughter of Sicilian immigrants, would be 104 years old today. She was born October 27th, 1912, and died 95 years later in 2008. She was proud she had her first opportunity to vote for a woman for President of the United States in the Oregon primary that year, Hillary Clinton, and would have voted for Barack Obama in the national election had she lived. The first presidential election of her life occurred 2 weeks after she was born. Woodrow Wilson, elected to his first term in 1912. 50 years ago today, she was 54. That was in 1966, the year I was in Vietnam. She told me just before I left for the war that she would disown me as her son if I used the threat of being an armed soldier to rape any woman or girl. Her rule of war was the one I strictly adhered to. I spent her birthday that year in isolated mountain jungles northwest of Chulai that had been abandoned by Western armies since the defeat of the French a dozen years earlier in 1954. The following occurred on October 27th, 1966. I call it Happy Birthday, Mother. Monsoon winds blew down from China one afternoon in late October and swept across the mountains of the Annamite Cordillera, the spinal cord of Vietnam. Huge columns of rain clouds, the winds freighted from the South China Sea, massed above sharp jungled peaks and streamed through high, shallow valleys that were terraced with rice fields or were wild and uninhabited. Rays of sunlight shot through the clouds like shifting cannon fire into wind-blown trees and palms that broke the shafts into spiked prisms and shadows. The wind was cold, and rain from the advancing clouds hammered the jungle ridges with a heavy roar, flooding valleys and peeling away the mottled walls of primitive homes built of mud and thatch, which were bunched together in lonely villages. Rain relentlessly poured down upon a haggard and straggled column of armed and helmeted men who were sliding down the muddy ridges toward a village in one of the smaller valleys. I was among them, second in the ragged file, and followed the point man into the valley. I was able to see the village beyond a maze of rain-swollen paddies, enclosed by walls of hedgerows and palms that were whipped by the wind. It was a skimpy place, wretchedly poor, as were most villages in the mountains. The farmers and their families lived a harsh existence and were killed early by disease, exhaustion, and hunger. In a sense, they were frontier people who had left their culture in the overcrowded coastal plains and settled on its rough fringes among Stone Age tribes they loathed and feared in much the manner of my own ancestors among the Western Indians. The village was an island amidst an ocean of drowned rice fields and seemed suspended in a history of approaching armies. I looked back at the other Marines stumbling down from the muddy ridges and saw their reflections in the brackish water of the rectangular paddies, cast against the salt and pepper sky like etchings of war gods. I noticed the point man was having a hard time crossing the valley along the spines of paddy dikes that collapsed under the weight of his boots. He was a short, fat man, hunched in his labored walk in the sucking mud, and were it not for his clothes and helmet, I might have mistaken him for one of the small apes that lived on the higher slopes. His back was bent, his hands grasped his knees and pushed his legs to drive them like sluggish pistons at one slippery step after another. His rifle swung loosely from a sling draped over his right shoulder and bruised his hip every move of his legs. His red, jowly face was haggard, almost cadaverous, shriveled like an old orange under the green and brown dappled steel bowl that covered his head, which swiveled from side to side almost mechanically. His chin and nose arched as if he was literally sniffing whatever might be ahead or around, an ambush hidden in the trees and bushes, a sniper in a palm tree taking aim. He abruptly dropped his head every few moments to detect explosive landmines or booby traps that might have been planted in the fields after the rice harvest a month earlier. His head seemed almost as loose as his rifle, and I would not have been surprised if it turned completely around and stared at me. The thought hardly formed. A shot cracked from the village. Its flat echo was the sound of a popped paper bag at the same instant the point man splashed backward into a paddy. A silence as sudden as the shot lasted only a second. Most of the other Marines dropped to the ground and started firing rifles and machine guns into the village. I discovered myself half submerged in water and mud, choking on slime and vomit. I tried to focus my eyes on something to shoot at, but saw only a small hill I had not noticed before. After a few seconds, I realized it was the point man's rounded stomach sticking out of the murky water like a dumpling in stew. A voice bellowed over the gunfire, and it raggedly ceased. The voice shouted again, and the Marines behind me began to withdraw back to the ridge. Three of us rushed over to the point man and started carrying him. He was dead. A hole in his right cheek blew out the back of his head, which dripped blood and brains after we lifted him from the paddy, and he had not taken an ounce of weight with him when he died. Our initial attempt to run slowed quickly to a lurching walk. I had his legs and pushed at him as if he were a wheelbarrow, desperate to get out of range of a second shot. We finally dropped his body next to a tree and covered him with a poncho. We spread out along the ridge bottom, which was heavily brushed, and pointed our weapons at the village. An officer crouched against an embankment and shouted into a radio for an airstrike. He shouted again at another officer who was trying to locate the village on a rain-soaked map and shouted back into the radio. We waited for the jets like executioners. The village was almost completely obscured by rain and by fogs rising from the fields. It appeared and disappeared as if straining to vanish before it was found by bombs, to become as much a phantom as the man or woman who had killed the point man. Two phantom jets came at sunset. The rain had stopped with a suddenness usual in the tropics, and the sky was rouged through holes in the darkening clouds. The jets shrieked down from the tops of the mountains and flew straight for the village, just above the mists that blanketed the fields. They barely cleared trees that encircled the village as they dropped aluminum canisters of napalm. Great jellied globes of fire erupted, instantly swallowed by billows of black smoke that were as immediately consumed by a terrible heat. The village caught fire. Houses exploded into flame. Their thatched roofs burst into the air. Palm trees flared into torches. Even the mists in the fields were burned away, and we who cowered at the bottom of the slope were slapped by the heat. The jets rolled back and came again. They dived down the same ridges and across the fields and dropped their last canisters into the flaming village. I stared at the fires. I felt the stinging heat against my nose and eyes and smelled the acrid smoke blown off the fires by the wind. Helicopter gunships flew in a few minutes after the jets left, and though they were tossed wildly by the wind, they careened over the paddies like large dragonflies. I heard the heavy clatter of their machine guns as they shot up the fields on the other side of the village. Two helicopters shot rockets into the burning village, then raked it with machine gun fire. A single helicopter broke off and flew toward us and landed next to green smoke erupting from a grenade tossed by an officer into the paddy in front of us. The point man's body was heaved into its open side door like a piece of rubbish. The helicopter lifted unsteadily into the air and with a great burst of power swung onto its side and arched around the mountain and flew across the wind. It rejoined its flock, which climbed over the jungled mountains and followed the jets southeast to the coast. We were left alone again. The sounds of machines and guns were replaced by final explosions of the fires in the village. We waited until they burned down and crossed the paddies at dusk. The wind blew into our faces and stung our eyes with smoke and ashes. A thin man led us this time. He took us past burnt animal pens, each with its own dead water buffalo. The blackened stalks of palm trees towered above us as we entered the ruined village. We first came upon an old man whose skin was burned green and black. He lay on a raised bed of wood that was charred and smoking. He wore a tattered purple robe that had caught on fire but was not entirely burned. His eyes were closed. Flies buzzed around his open mouth. His stiffened arms and hands were raised toward the sky. The wind blew at his scorched white hair. We next passed an elderly man and woman whose bodies lay like curled fruit peelings in front of a house that had burned to a bed of glowing coals. The thin man hacked through a wall of broken and smoking bushes with a machete. We emerged from the ruined hedgerow into a stone courtyard that was bordered on three sides by a lone stone wall. At its center was a house, its white walls built of stucco and mud, topped by a peaked clay cobbled roof that had partially collapsed. The walls were stained by moss and in parts overgrown with vines, some of which had been set afire. The courtyard was filled with the bodies of children. Some of them were horribly burned or mangled. Others seemed only asleep, their skins a bright cherry color, as if they had merely been sunburned. A few bodies were not complete, and others were more than one, possibly fused by heat. There were at least a score of them, older children, young children, and babies. I stopped and stared at them. I tried to walk away, but I could not move. I did not want to look at them, but I was horrified and could not stop staring. I almost vomited the same instant my eyes filled with tears. My mind started to unstick. Thin calluses that had spread over my sensibilities blistered and ruptured like scabs of wounds. I was engulfed in despair and shame. Ugly sights of broken children in cities and villages superimposed over the bodies, starved and emaciated children whose arms or legs were fly-infested stumps, whose small bodies were raw and bleeding from wounds and sores, who begged and stole for food like desperate young wolves and died alone and unmourned, sometimes murdered by each other. I tried to shut them out of my eyes for months. I had deafened my ears to their screams and pleas, but they persistently haunted my thoughts and filled my dreams. I knew instantly and with chilling certainty that the dead children in the courtyard had been left there intentionally, carried from all parts of the burning village by survivors who fled into the fields away from us, perhaps many of them killed by the helicopters that hunted in the wake of the jets on the far side of the valley. My friend Willie Mack stopped and stood with me over the bodies. His eyes were empty, his gaunt face expressionless. Marines passed us and moved deeper into the ravaged village. Their rifles darted nervously, like snakes searching for prey. A few looked at the children. Most tried not to. They did not want to add these deaths to their imperiled lives. They saved their sympathy for themselves. "They left them for us," I said almost in a whisper. I felt Willie Mack's sudden, hard gripping of my arm, pulling me away. "Come on," he said. "It's no good." I stumbled along with him through the broken village. we came across more bodies, steaming with flies, and in some instances, parts of bodies and the bodies of several dead pigs, dogs, and water buffalo that had been cremated in pens behind burnt houses. We found some Marines sitting on the hard dirt floor of a partially roofed house, which was fringed by a grove of blackened palm trees. "Find some place to crap out," one of the Marines said. "We're staying the night." We shared the village with the dead who remained where they died. Heavy rain fell most of the night. I leaned against the door frame of a house that was not completely destroyed and stared out into the dark toward the moldy courtyard and the dead children. My vision was obscured by smashed, burnt dwellings and hedgerows and by the ghostly density of rain and fogs that rose from the mud and were whipped by the wind into tattered streamers that seemed to be souls leaving the dead, wreathing around the scattered ashes of their homes before vanishing into the stormy sky. I imagined the bodies of the children, withered and curled like leaves fallen from trees, pounded by monsoon rains into compost, their blood leached by the rain, their horrible burns cooled and softened. I turned and shouted into the darkness of the house. "Why didn't they get the hell out of here? They knew we were coming. They knew we'd blow them up." "Shut up," Willie Mack hissed. "You almost got yourself convinced it's their own fault they're dead." "Oh, bullshit. You probably wouldn't even give a damn if you hadn't seen the kids." "I've seen kids blown away." "Sure, but not like this," he said quietly. "You're scared. You think those kids are your death warrant. You think they're going to get you for this. What about the sniper?" "What about him? All he did was pop one of our guys. We turned their kids into torches." Of course he was right. I was terrified by the hatred behind the display of the dead children and the vengeance their deaths demanded. I felt I would be hunted down for their murders, and if I escaped Vietnam, that eventually my own mind would be the hunter. I smoked a cigarette and rolled into a poncho on the floor of the house, but was unable to sleep. I lay awake for a long time and finally became aware that it was my mother's birthday. I had forgotten. Perhaps the dead children reminded me. I wondered if any of their mothers remained alive, and I felt again my fear of their grief and hatred. "Happy birthday, Mother," I whispered. "Your kids are dead." "You say something," Willie Mack's voice croaked. "I was thinking of my mother." "You're a cesspool of neuroses," he said disgustedly. "I just remembered it's her birthday." "Happy birthday, Mother," Willie Mack said. The next day, we left the dead village and climbed the mountains on the far side of the valley. And that was "Happy Birthday, Mother," which I wrote. A woman who used to live in Astoria named Lori Brown was born the day we left the village of dead children, October 28, 1966. She is 50 tomorrow. The same date of birth of Adam and Eve in 4004 B.C., as proclaimed by the venerable Bishop of Usher 350 years ago. And as a footnote, the famous English Battle of Hastings occurred 950 years ago on October 14, 1066. Exactly 9 centuries later, an American military operation by U.S. Marines against regiments of the North Vietnamese Army on the DMZ in July 1966 was named Hastings, after the original clash between Normans and Saxons, probably the brainchild of an eager young staff officer who wished to impress his superiors with his knowledge of military history. And now, Old Man, which I also wrote. He was just an old man, bent and scabby-legged, sores all over his dark, calloused feet, 3 long chin whiskers curling from his ancient, crumbling jaw like nonsensical banners. He was waving one, a flag, yellow with 3 red stripes. He was standing beside his hut. Kids were running everywhere, yelling at the Marines walking through the village. A tiny village alongside a river, chickens, ugly pigs, skinny dogs, scrawny old women with black teeth and frightened smiles because they thought the Americans might kill their men or burn down their homes. So everybody pretended to be friendly, and the old man hid his Viet Cong flag and brought out the Saigon absurdity, waving and smiling to beat hell. But Fat Jack saw him, and Fat Jack had never shot down anybody in cold blood. Jack had this thing. He wanted to kill somebody. And here was this ridiculous old man. Who would miss him? Just an old man. He couldn't work in the fields anymore. Another hungry stomach for a family loaded down with kids to feed. So Jack walked up to him, and the old man started bobbing his head up and down, faster and smiling wider, but it didn't matter. Jack had the rifle in his face and the trigger pulled before the old man's body knew it was dead. He didn't fall. He just stood there without much of a face, a squashed, dripping berry. The back of his head looked like a busted balloon. Then he fell, old knees buckling on withered legs. His ass hit first, then the rest of him, sitting hunched over for a second, collapsing on its side. "I don't feel nothing," Jack shouted. The guys just smiled. The kids stopped running, quiet. The old women scooted back into their huts. A low wailing began to throb through the village, but Jack was walking away, shaking his head, telling his friends he just didn't feel nothing. The old man, he had a lot of blood for such a small, skinny, used-up old man. He was left to lay there. Nobody touched him, not the kids, not the women, just the flies coming from all over the village, the fields. And that was Old Man. I wrote this story when I was in Vietnam 50 years ago. I was a USMC reporter-photographer, well aware the Marine Corps would not print it in the Sea Tiger, Pendleton Scout, or Leatherneck, nor would Stars and Stripes. Stateside papers didn't want it either when I got back. It was initially included in Free Fire Zone, short stories by Vietnam veterans, published by First Casualty Press and Vietnam Veterans Against the War in 1974. And now, to continue the theme, Vietnam War Weapons, Crossbows versus Jets, from United Press International. And this was 1964 or 1965, I'm not quite sure. Never before in American history has so much been spent to kill so few as in the Vietnam War. It's the most one-sided fight since the British amassed their wealth and firepower to wipe out the rebels in 1776. And if the official reports are to be believed, the war in Vietnam is going just about as badly for the Americans as the Revolution went for the British. Just about every modern weapon of warfare except the atomic bomb is being supplied by the Americans. There are jet bombers, jet fighters, helicopters by the hundreds, artillery ranging from pack howitzers to 155s, small mortars, medium mortars, and big mortars, grenades, machine guns, aircraft carriers, destroyers and cruisers, single-engine planes, twin-engine planes, and four-engine planes. There are propeller planes and turboprop planes. There are electronic devices so secret and so ingenious that they are worth six times the value of the big planes carrying them. There is radar so complex only specialists can maintain it. There are fire bombs, fragmentation bombs, and armor-piercing bombs. There is the most modern and expensive communication system ever used in any war, with newer and more expensive communication systems being installed. The target for America's might is a barefoot conglomeration of nondescripts, whose biggest weapons are a few heavy mortars and 57-millimeter recoilless rifles. For a Navy, the Reds have a few sampans in the Mekong Delta and some motorized junks along the coast. Nothing they have afloat carries any armament heavier than machine guns or automatic weapons, and all are used as transports, none as men of war. There isn't a steel hull in the entire Communist Navy, and the propulsion units are sails, wheezy engines, or oars. Yet this Red Fleet is one of the main pipelines of supplies into South Vietnam. With no air force, the Reds have no air evacuation. American helicopters and C-123s fly seriously wounded Americans and South Vietnamese to rear area surgeries. The pack carrying South Vietnamese and American infantrymen go forth to battle with proven rapid-fire guns, continuous communications, bombers overhead, artilleries and mortars and medical facilities at their side. The Viet Cong often use a crossbow against aircraft, has no shoes, no artillery, no bombers, guns that often misfire, no radar, and relies almost entirely upon either homemade or captured armaments to fill his arsenal. If seriously wounded, he dies. And that was from United Press International, Vietnam War. Vietnam War Weapons, Crossbows versus Jets. And it was published either in 1964 or 1965 in the Pasadena Independent Star News. And was sort of what it was like when I went there in 1966. And as an epilogue in closing, I wish to commemorate two eminent and extraordinary Astorians who have been dead 25 years, Harry and Mary Steinbach. Harry Steinbach was mayor of Astoria for 16 years, from 1959 to 1975, and though such opinions are subjective, he was among the best of the city's mayors, testimonial of which are the several times he was elected. He and Mary were liked and trusted, both of whom capable of seeking reason among adversities. Among their accomplishments as Astoria's first family were the city library and establishment of Clatsop Community College. But the most challenging and singular accomplishment was their leading role in making John Jacob Astor's hometown of Waldorf, Germany, as Astoria's sister city. It was hard for them because they were Jewish, and both had lost family members in Hitler's Holocaust of World War II. When Mary and Harry visited Waldorf with a delegation in 1970, they said they were prepared to be resentful of the Germans. Instead, Mary and Harry became the toasts of the city, and a street was named after them, Steinbachstrasse. Citizens of Waldorf were their guests in Astoria for the rest of their lives. They sponsored students of both cities to visit each city. Harry died in October 1991 at age 82, and Mary in April 1992 at age 79. Mary continued to be involved in community affairs right up to her death. She was the Eleanor Roosevelt of Astoria, and most assuredly its eternal First Lady in the most expansive sense of the term. The late Dale Curry, who was Astoria city manager throughout the 16 years of the Steinbach residency, said of them, "You can't have a king and queen as mayor, but they came as close to being king and queen of Astoria in my heart as anybody." Tom Hayden has died. Read his manifesto, the Port Huron Statement, especially if you haven't voted already. And if you have read it, but not recently, read it again. It is a demand that democracy be real. In closing, I would like to read a poem by Jan Barry, who was initially the founder of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He served in Vietnam in 1964 and 65. In the footsteps of Genghis Khan, there, where a French legionnaire once walked patrol around the flight line perimeter of the airfield at Nha Trang, 10 years later I walked, an American Foreign Expeditionary Forces soldier on night guard duty at Nha Trang, occupied even earlier, 20 years before, a year more than my 19, by the Japanese. Unhaunted by the ghosts living and dead among us, in the red tile roofed French barracks, or listening in on the old Japanese telephone line to Saigon, we went about our military duties, setting up special forces headquarters where once a French Foreign Legion post had been, oblivious of the irony of Americans walking in the footsteps of Genghis Khan, unencumbered by history, our own, or that of 13th century Mongol armies, long since fled or buried by the Vietnamese, in Nha Trang, in 1964, We just did our jobs, replacing kepis with berets, aso with God, with a G-A-W-D. And one more, Vietnam, by Robert C. Hahn, also a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and both poems printed by Vietnam Vets Against the War, Winning Hearts and Minds, War Poems by Vietnam Veterans. Vietnam, land of volcanic hills, time-warped mountains, lichened rivers and rain-scented heat, land of rice, palms, and poverty, patience, struggle, and violence, land of war, land of silence, proud people whose ravished children speak the beggar's tongue, whose girls whore the invader, whose men salute the rapist, at night hunt the rabid beast. Enslaved in the name of freedom, you watch invader kill invader, you watch your children die, watch the others speak of peace, suffer sorrows without cease. This has been Michael McCusker. Happy Halloween.